Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 92, it's Journal Club, as Dr. Jonathan Chang and Dr. Ajay Kurian join me. We discuss three recent papers from ophthalmology concerning pan-retinal laser photocoagulation versus pan-retinal laser photocoagulation with anti-VEGF therapy for high-risk proliferative diabetic retinopathy, an IRIS registry study describing real-world intraocular pressure changes with prolonged anti-VEGF therapy, and selection of academic department chairs in ophthalmology. All articles can be found with links on the website and in the episode description.
Hello.
Hey.
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 All right, let's do this. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retinal specialists for our journal club. First in alphabetical order, Dr. Jonathan Chang from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. John, welcome back.
Hi, Jay. Thanks again for having me. Great to be with you.
And also on the line, one of the two Knicks fans in the world, along with John Chang, Dr. Ajay Kurian from the University of Rochester. Ajay, welcome.
Thanks again for having me back, Jay.
So we're going to discuss three publications from ophthalmology, and the first is entitled Ranibizumab plus Panretinal Photocoagulation versus Panretinal Photocoagulation Alone for High-Risk Proliferative Diabetic Retinopathy, known as the PROTEUS study. This was published online, I'm looking for the date here, this is published online in late January this year. And Ajay, tell us a little bit about the way this paper and study was designed.
So this is a prospective study of high-risk PDR patients. Those 87 patients that were enrolled, and they were randomized to either a combination therapy of ranibizumab and PRP or just PRP monotherapy. And so that combination group received three monthly ranibizumab treatments, and during that time, PRP was performed. And then if they required more treatment, they would get a combination treatment of ranibizumab and PRP. On the other hand, the control group was the PRP monotherapy group, and so they were required to have their PRP done between day one and month two, and retreatments were only PRP treatments. If any patients developed macular edema requiring anti-VEGF treatments, they were then excluded from the study. And so they were looking at the outcomes. Their primary outcome was regression of the total amount of neovascularization. And then they also looked, that was the combination of the neovascularization on the disc and elsewhere. And they assessed this by looking at fundus photos and fluorescein angiography, and they had a pre-trial setup for measuring how the area of these changes, and were able to compare this. They also looked at other changes like complete regression, visual acuity, macular thickness, and then need for additional treatments for other complications from the PDR like vitreous hemorrhage or TRDs. What they found was that there was a larger amount of regression of the neovascularization in the combination group compared to the monotherapy group. When they broke it up to look at the neovascularization on the disc or the elsewhere, they found that it was only significant for the NVE, but there was a fairly large difference between the neovascularization of the disc also. They also found that this happened faster for these patients, and they required less additional therapies for those complications.
So we're going to talk a little bit like we do normally about limitations and take-home points, but we're going to go through a couple points that thought interesting. I'm going to ask John first. So, John, one of the things they mentioned they found in their study that Ajay just referenced and has been found in previous studies is that the idea of the NVD and the NVE, and there's differences in the regression of these two. Were you surprised, you know, by the fact that, and does it surprise you that NVD is more likely to be, I should have said less likely to regress with either PRP plus or minus anti-VEGF?
So saying that it was, sorry, Jay, say it again, was it surprising that
NVD is less likely to regress than NVE?
Oh, so that basically, you know, the difference was significant for NVE, but not for NVD, I guess is what you're saying, right?
Right. Like,
is that surprising?
That, as well as just the fact NVD, regardless of group and in previous studies, just regresses less than NVE.
Yeah, I have to admit, I don't know the specifics of pathophysiology that differentiates NVD versus NVE, right? And so, you would think, well, shouldn't neovascularization everywhere be somewhat equal? But, I mean, it certainly seems consistent, as you said, with before. You know, we look at NVD usually as a higher risk sign than just some NVE.
Right.
And usually, you know, it's thought that traction along, you know, the NVDs may be what leads to vitreous hemorrhage in certain patients. I mean, I think, you know, probably to me, the one question would be, you know, is a year really enough time to really assess which is going to clear up faster?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, within a year, giving injections helps clear things up quicker just overall. But maybe, you know, if you went a year and a half or 2 years follow-up, then you'd see maybe that difference in the NVD more clearly.
Yeah. And the other thing that was odd when they talked about the discussion and the results was there's a paragraph that states, approximately 67% of the eyes in the study group that achieved a total regression of NV had a recurrence of new vessels. This was in contrast to reactivation NV did not occur in the PRP monotherapy group, highlighting a more consistent and permanent effect of PRP in the addition of the NV. They go on to say, though, the monotherapy group received more laser burns, and therefore they may have gotten a more complete PRP. I mean, when you were looking at the methods, one of the things I was looking for, it looked like they standardized the PRP treatment between the groups, but they were referencing that the PRP may have been and was more in the monotherapy group than in the anti-VEGF group.
Yeah, so I think that they tried to standardize the PRP, but then the fill-in that was necessary was at the discretion of the investigator, from what I understood. And so I think that one of the things that often concerns me about using an anti-VEGF agent along with my PRP is that it might make it look like the patient has regressed totally or for the most part with my PRP and my combination anti-VEGF, but I don't know how much of that is the anti-VEGF effect and how much of that is the PRP effect with the thought that the anti-VEGF is temporary and might come back. And, you know, they did, like you said, have more experiences of the NV recurring after total regression in that combination group, which I think speaks to that problem.
So I'm going to ask you guys a question with a follow-up related to the study. I'll start with John. How do you determine when you see a patient with treatment-naive, high-risk PDR, how do you determine the extent of PRP that you do?
I think usually if you have, you know, high-risk PDR, you try to give, at least I try to give full PRP. You know, I think the limitations become more logistics for me, like discomfort of the patient, you know, maybe... You know, full PRP for me is going to be at least 1,500 applications, but, mm-hmm. you know, I've had patients where 1,500 applications isn't that tight to the macula or the arcades either. So, you know, that does leave some room for some fill-in. I have supplemented more recently. I have been supplementing more with anti-VEGF as well, just because I do think clinically you see these regressions a little quicker. And so then you feel like maybe it just buys you a little more time. Some of these patients can go downhill pretty fast, especially if you see them in pretty advanced stage. But I think...
Do you get a fluorescein routinely on every new PDR patient with high-risk PDR, or do you just go straight to treatment?
I do not get a fluorescein at baseline on every PDR patient. I think it really... Sometimes you can just tell they have a lot of NVD. It's pretty clear, you know. You know, or they may have even had... Yeah, vitreous hemorrhage.
Ajay, how about you?
So I don't get a fluorescein for these patients routinely if they're high risk PDR. You know, certainly if I see some changes, I'm trying to determine if there's more NV than I think there is, and I'm on the fence between them being high risk or just regular PDR, then I get an FA to see if that would push me over the edge for a treatment.
Okay, that's the same for me for the FA, Jay. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's those kind of borderline, you know, they kind of look like they are on the cusp of high risk, or maybe severe NPDR even, but you know they've had diabetes a long time, and there's just maybe some very subtle NV that you're not seeing on the exam.
Right. So the reason I asked that question, and to not just be grilling you guys, I do very similarly where I'll get the FA initially if they're borderline. If they're clearly PDR, then I'll initiate PRP. But the question is always how much, right? Does every patient need the full? Does full mean up to the arcades to aura in every patient? And this is going to the debate that, you know, has been going back to the days of the big studies has been undertaken. And now that we have anti-VEGF, the question is that we know that anti-VEGF, based on certain studies, can regress neovascularization and may actually lead to some reperfusion of previously non-perfused areas of the retina. The question we don't know is, does that hold true for diabetics of every degree of severity of non-perfusion? And so this is what Ajay was referencing and what this study was talking about in terms of the recurrence of NV. If you're injecting anti-VEGF up front and you don't have an FA, it can be difficult sometimes to scale how much PRP you're going to do. Now, they tried to standardize the Ajay's reference, but they still ended up doing less treatment because of the fill-ins in the anti-VEGF group, probably because the PRP group, they would do a PRP, they would still have neovascularization, so they'd fill them in. Anti-VEGF, as Ajay referenced, and you know, if you inject anti-VEGF, you're much more likely to get complete NV regression, and maybe you don't see the need for the full PRP with the fill-ins after you feel like you've already gotten your full treatment. So that was one point that was interesting. The other thing is that when they talked about dropout, I don't know if you guys noticed, so they talked about loss to follow-up. They had 10 patients who did not finish the visit schedule, 8 from the PRP group, and 2 from the combined ranibizumab PRP group. And of the 8 who dropped out of the PRP group, 7 were due to diabetic retinopathy complications. And so there is definitely, and they even in the patients who were included, there's a higher rate of quote-unquote complications, whether that's DME or vitreous hemorrhage or other. There's also a higher rate of, you know, need for vitrectomy, as was seen in protocol S. So let's talk about limitations a little bit. We referenced a couple. Ajay, any major limitations besides, you know, just the one-year follow-up John referenced?
You know, I think that that's one of the biggest limitations, especially when you're looking at a combination of what we perceive to be as a temporary treatment and a more permanent lasting treatment. And especially when you put that in context with the regression after the total elimination of the neovascularization. I think other things is that it wasn't ultra wide field imaging. And so that could possibly result in an underestimation of some of the changes that we're seeing. Now, thus far, standard clinical trials haven't used ultra-wide field imaging, but it definitely makes you wonder what you're missing when you're not doing ultra-wide field imaging, given the rapid adoption of that imaging technology. I think the one of the other limitations is just like what we talked about before, that that fill-in pattern being at the discretion of the of the investigator, because that leads to some of these differences in the amount of PRP that's put in.
The other thing is, and I noticed in the paper, at least I couldn't find what dosing of ranibizumab they gave, and I had to look online, and they give the 0.5 milligram dose of ranibizumab. And, you know, I think in Europe, I believe, oh, sorry, I did say the very first line, I should it's a 0.5 ranibizumab, right? And so I believe in Europe, right, that's the standard, whereas here in the U.S. it's 0.3, which, you know, you're always just not quite sure how to take that, you know, does the dose make a difference? And then I think the other thing, too, is, like, protocol S came out since then, right? And so we don't have a group of patients who are just getting ranibizumab alone to compare with. And maybe the laser in the ranibizumab laser group wasn't really doing that much. You know, there's no way to know that for sure, right?
Well, I mean, again, we should always take science and RCT over anecdotal experience, but Ajay referenced this earlier. I've said this before in the program. I think that while anti-VEGF is a great addition to armamentarium, there may be PDR patients who can be treated completely with anti-VEGF. I'm very reluctant, maybe it's just been, you know, not to, no pun intended, I've been burned by seeing that, you know, patients who either don't follow through with the monthly schedule of injections or who just come off the injections and may have recurrent neovascularization and complications from that, that there is still, as of right now in 2018, a big role for PRP. So I would, maybe you're right. Maybe if you did that ranibizumab in a study scenario, 1 year ranibizumab PRP, like protocol S, or and then versus a PRP group and split the groups that way, maybe you wouldn't see a tangible difference. But I think that's a very, that'd be a different, difficult and dangerous conclusion to swallow.
Well, I mean, I agree, Jay, I agree with you that, you know, laser has still a role, but, you know, that you want to kind of know, right, you know, okay, you know, there's these studies now, right, that show, okay, we can just do primarily anti-VEGF, right? We know most people probably practice a combination of laser and anti-VEGF. Wouldn't it be nice to, I guess, see, you know, what contribution each is doing? And I think it's kind of this rapid improvement. That's kind of what the study shows, right? That's probably more the anti-VEGF, you know, contribution, and then kind of that more durable treatment, which they kind of suspect was the reason that their combination group didn't, you know, have as much recurrence. You know, it's probably that's what's more durable. But, you know, I guess it would be nice to know, hey, actually the PRP group, sorry, had less recurrence, like, in the long run, but the combination group had faster regression. And then if you had just an alone anti-VEGF group, you could see, oh, yeah, it wasn't as durable, I guess, you know, like, as almost like a proof of the point that you're trying to make, I think.
Right, right. And I think that the thing Ajay mentioned about the fill-in, we were talking about the fill-in, I think that's a big confounder, right? Because the laser is not standardized, it seems, between the group because of that fill-in. So it would have been, like, if you're just thinking from the perspective of your fellow or med student or you're a resident, or fellow or med student, you're trying to think about study design and you just referenced a way you could have redesigned the study or improved it. The other thing that would be nice if you did FA-guided fill-in or you had some sort of criteria for fill-in PRP to kind of standardize it between the two groups. You know, maybe that difference in terms of recurrence rate disappears. And then if you have a ranibizumab group for a year, maybe the study is a little stronger. So take home points we always talk about for each study. So Ajay first, does this change anything in how, in terms of how you approach high-risk PDR?
So I think for many of the reasons that you described, I think the approach that I usually take is a combination of anti-VEGF and PRP. It's nice to see that studied and validated as having some pros compared to just PRP alone or anti-VEGF. Alone, we don't have that answer. I think that that comparison would have been great, like John said, an ideal study, and perhaps it's fodder for a future study to look at that. But I think it definitely shows some benefit of having that combination, which is what I generally tend to use right now. I think another thing that's always interesting in these PRP versus anti-VEGF studies, and now in this PRP versus combination anti-VEGF and PRP study, is the visual acuity. Although it wasn't statistically significant in this study, there were more letters gained in the combination group compared to the PRP only group. And I think that's something that still needs to be fully worked out, why we're seeing this happening again and again. But it certainly has a potential role for more anti-VEGF treatment in these patients.
Ajay, do you think that was also potentially related to the fact they did focal laser for the diabetic macular edema in those patients?
You know, it is certainly possible that's why. But I think from what I was reading, there was only a small amount of patients who got treatment for the macular edema, and I thought that those patients were actually treated with ranibizumab when we were drawn from the study. So I know in the protocol they gave the option for the focal, but I'm trying to...
Oh, yeah, there was just two. There was just two that got macular.
Yeah, and then they actually got ranibizumab and were taken out of the study.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned the vision, Ajay, but they also... The only statistically significant difference between the groups at baseline, your famous table one with your demographics, was that for whatever reason the combo group was a little older. So when they adjusted for age, actually, the vision became visually statistically significant. So that's a good point.
It's always hard in relatively smaller studies like this one to do these additional analyses. You wonder about the effect of that. But we do have larger studies that show similar outcome.
And then what did you guys make of the prior, you know, the patients weren't all treatment naive, right? So some of them had prior PRP before being involved.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll just quick note. I just think from a study design perspective, if you're trying to recruit, depending on where you are, like if you're in, you know, Miami or Houston or LA, it can be very easy to recruit patients for a PDR study. But Getting treatment naive patients, maybe from just like a logistics perspective, they just couldn't, they didn't, or in planning, they didn't know if they could get enough treatment naive patients that included them. But I think that's a very good point about maybe something else that's a confounder, though, when you adjust, look at the stats, it wasn't really different between the two groups.
Yeah, you know, they said that's kind of like a more real world situation that patients wouldn't be totally treatment naive. I just wonder how that affects your ability to like, you know, someone's got PDR despite having some PRP, you know, and how much, you know, is there something maybe just more aggressive or different about their disease, you know, or about their blood sugar control or something like that?
Well, any last thoughts on this paper? It was a good study, something we're both all very interested in. We're going to jump to another anti-VEGF study, which is also from ophthalmology. It's entitled The Real World Effect of Intravitreous Antivascular Endothelial Growth Factor Drugs on Intraocular Pressure, an analysis using the IRIS Registry. First author was Elizabeth Atchison, who is, ironically enough, a listener to the podcast, and we talked about one of her articles before. And senior author is Matt McCumber. This was published also in late January in Ophthalmology. John, you want to tell us a little bit about the way this study was designed and its results?
Sure. So this is actually, I think, one of the first handful of studies that's come out using data from the IRIS Registry. So if people aren't familiar with the IRIS Registry, that's something that the Academy set up a few years ago for practices to upload their data to kind of meet the CMS quality metrics that were being required in terms of reporting. So Academy's had a really big push towards getting practices, institutions to be involved with IRIS Registry reporting. I believe it's one of the larger databases of this sort. So, you know, across all of medicine. So that's also very exciting. And then there were actually some restrictions on getting data from Epic systems, but that's now been overcome. So in the future, I think a lot of the academic institutions will be able to participate in sending their data as well onto IRIS Registry. So this was basically a study that looked at using the data from the registry from, I believe, 2013 to 2015, and to look at patients who had received anti-VEGF injections and to look at the impact of, on their intraocular pressure. There have been a number of, you know, a lot of people have been looking into this, and there's been a lot of questions about what's it mean if you, every month or every on some regular basis you're getting these injections and kind of elevating the pressure somewhat. Some studies from clinical trials have shown a significant increase in IOP from multiple injections. Others have shown no difference, and so there's also been a number of kind of retrospective studies people have done in their own practices trying to see if there's been any, you know, correlation with elevated IOPs. And so this was, you know, I think a good question to ask using a one of the largest databases now of information. So they went through the registry in order to kind of limit and remove some bad data. They actually included only right eyes of patients, and the patients had to have at least one measurement prior to the first injection. And then they kind of found other bad data, things like if you had at least one or two very irregular readings, such as lower than 5 millimeters of mercury pressure reading, or 75 or more IOP readings over 2 years. And so that left them down to about 23,776 patients. And so primarily these were AMD, but also DME and vein occlusion patients. And then they looked at those IOP changes. So they defined an IOP elevation as someone who has a baseline IOP of less than 21 millimeters of mercury, and a rise would be 6 millimeter of mercury rise. They used a fellow eye as a comparison, so an uninjected fellow eye. And then their results showed that in all of all eyes receiving injections, they had a clinically significant increase, as they had defined it, in 2.6% of eyes, as compared to 1.5% of eyes in the untreated group having an elevated IOP. So that was the kind of overall message. They did break it down by medication as well. And, you know, I think the, you know, the, I guess the conclusion they kind of drew was, yes, there was a rise, but in a very small number of patients, and it probably was not clinically significant.
Yeah. So, Ajay, your thoughts upon hearing that and reading this article?
So I think, you know, it hasn't really been something that I talk to my patients about when talking about risks and things like that. I think it's something, one promising aspect was that of all the patients who had the elevated in IOP, less than 0.1% actually needed an incisional surgery. But I think that with such a large database showing that although it is a small number of patients who get this rise, it is a possibility. And I think it's something that, you know, needs to be incorporated into your initial discussion about the anti-VEGF treatment, but with the solace that very few people actually need a surgical intervention for controlling that in that small percent of people who get that right.
Yeah, that's a very impressive use of the word solace. That's like our grammar word, our diction word of the day. Knicks fans know all about solace. You know, I think that the interesting thing, which they didn't really have a good explanation, John referenced, was the difference between the medications. That, you know, this rate of IOP increased to more than 21 millimeters of mercury was not present compared to fellow eyes in aflibercept, but it was with ranibizumab and bevacizumab. And they said, you know, they kind of discussed that a sub-analysis of U1 and U2 kind of matched that, that there was... They referenced that PDGF as part of the aflibercept mechanism. Maybe that affects TM, but that's just an odd side note that maybe for the aflibercept rooting crowd that maybe there's some benefit there, though it's not really clear why. Limitations, John, as always, big data studies, big limitations of a study like this?
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing, and actually I talked to Matt McCumber at a meeting because I've been working on a proposal to do some research with the IRIS registry, and just to kind of talk to him about it. I think one of the big issues right now with IRIS registry is we just don't know how good the data is. I mean, you hope that when you have, you know, they started out with 972,000 patients. So you hope that when you have a database that big, that, you know, errors or problems in the data get weeded out, and they certainly tried their best to reduce those problems. But, you know, you wonder, you know, overall in this case, there's not like a standard pressure measurement, right? So different practices are inputting their information. You don't know, well, in one practice, it could have been tonopen. In another practice or institution, it could have been applanation. And, you know, the patient, you're assuming along the way, is getting the same pressure measurement each time, but it may be totally different. You know, you just don't know. And so you can't always compare those pressure changes, right? If someone has a pressure of, you know, now you'd hope that it wouldn't be 6 millimeters of mercury. However, you know, I would say in general, retina practices, I don't think are that, you know, focused on pressure measurements either, you know. And so, you know, our glaucoma colleagues probably would not, you know, don't really probably trust our measurements right as closely for whatever, you know, and with reason. I mean, it's not a highlight of the exam often. And so, you know, that could be one potential issue, is just kind of data integrity. You know, they actually mentioned in their discussion, they didn't know if patients had changed any of their topical glaucoma medicines because there was no laterality associated with the medication. So you don't know if, you know, patients were started on topical medications, and maybe that's why their pressures over the course of time appeared to stay the same, even though perhaps they were actually increasing and someone started them on some medication. We also don't know, at least I didn't see him here, you know, cataract surgery. So did people have cataract surgery in between over the course of their treatment? And that maybe affect their pressure. Sometimes cataract surgery can lower your pressure a few points.
That's a really, really good point about the cataract surgery. And, you know, this is a different debate for a different topic. And I don't think any of us are experts on big data. But this is kind of like the argument about big data, right? Is big data awesome because you have so many numbers that these small discrepancies in the measurements and everything kind of wash out because of the numbers? Or is it from a statistical perspective, and if you start with small piles of statistical kind of noise due to, differences in measurement because it's not standardized, does that add up to just a huge amount of noise that looks like something? And the truth is probably somewhere in between. You just kind of take big data for what it is. It's real world data, as they reference, but it's not the same as a prospective study.
And then just one other thing, Jay, if you look at the number of patients that had 25 or more injections, you start with 23,000 patients in their cohort, and then it goes down to 413 had 25 or more injections. That's great, but some of these clinical trials probably reached numbers close to that. So in terms of the, power of the numbers of patients, you kind of start losing it a little bit because, it looks like only 5,500 of the 23,000 even had 12 or more injections, right? And so, I think the hypothesis of these pressure problems with injections isn't from people who had just a few injections. It's people who are getting kind of chronic therapy, maybe being a little more vulnerable. And so, kind of how does that play a role?
Right, that's a good point. The other thing I thought of, and I'm curious to see you guys, I was trying to figure it out reading, they kind of this confounder analysis to kind of minimize the confounders. But when they did their analysis, they found that bevacizumab was actually more likely to have, a slight increase compared to aflibercept or ranibizumab. And then I was trying to figure out, if you had a patient, for example, because bevacizumab is often used for your first line if you can't get approval for other agents. But if you had a patient, for example, neovascular glaucoma, the confounder analysis should have thrown that out, right? So if they presented with a pressure of 50 and PDR and NVG, and then, you're treating them with bevacizumab, and maybe that patient ends up with a higher IOP, average IOP at the end, but maybe before they came with 50, they were 15, who knows? If that's all you could get that day, does the analysis get rid of that because of the what you're talking about, because they have that kind of screen?
I'm not sure, but I guess the only other thing I could tell you is diabetics made up a smaller percentage of their patients. So in that particular kind of example, hopefully, it was, I think, 3/4 were basically AMD patients.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There were some, there was this 4% that had a combination of diagnoses. That's another kind of thing you wonder, is that an off-label use, or what is that? If you have a combination of DME and AMD.
Or maybe DME and RVO.
Right.
Ajay, any final thoughts on this before we move forward?
I think John hit upon all the major points in terms of the limitations and the strengths of this big data, and especially concerning this study with when you go down to the 25 or more injections. I think that the IRIS data registry has a ton of data, and we're really excited to be able to try to use that. And I think that, just like John said, controlling for those confounders and those key things when you're making the study design is key, because no matter how big your data set is, unless you control for all the things that will cause confounding factors in the outcomes, you're not going to be able to quite get the answer that you might want to get.
Well, guys, those are the two research articles we're going to hit today. The last article we're going to hit is actually an editorial. And we usually don't do editorials for Journal Club, but this was one that we all read and we thought it was interesting, so we thought we'd have a brief discussion. This is from February 2018, Ophthalmology. It's entitled Open Search or Rotating Leadership, Thoughts Concerning Selecting Chairs for an Academic Ophthalmology Department. It's by Dan Albert and George Bartley. And first of all, none of us have ever been chair or close to being chairs of the department. These guys bring tons more experience and knowledge about the process. And, I'm going to defer to that when we talk about their ideas. But Ajay, you just want to tell us a little bit about the sort of ideas that were discussed in this editorial?
Sure. So, the editorial went through a few things. One, they started with just going over the historical role of a chair compared to what a chair is doing now. And then they highlighted two different types of searches. So one is an open search where you're essentially trying to recruit somebody that can be internal or external. And then the other option is to do an internal rotation of a chair. And so having more senior faculty sort of rotate for a specified period to be the faculty chairman or chairwoman. And so just going over some of the pros and cons of both of those different sort of techniques or approaches.
So let's talk a little bit about I thought the most interesting thing, which was very, very honest, was they had a table talking about the possible criteria to measure departmental success. And this is in no particular order, but the table had things such as U.S. News and World Report rankings, Ophthalmology Times rankings, department earnings or clinical volume, research funding, intellectual property, faculty recruitment, faculty retention, and then the quality of the residents and fellows. Again, I mean, the world has changed, right? And one of the things we've talked about a ton on the podcast is we have kind of this, no longer we don't have this binary system of academic and private. We have this blurred lines where you have academic centers that are very focused on developing their healthcare brand and how they market to patients, increasing revenue and volume. And that's maybe how they're being more judged in terms of how successful they are. And you have private practices that are more invested in the research side of things. John, do you have any thoughts after reading this? Or, you know, anything that makes you go forward in terms of, do you like this rotating chair idea that was suggested?
Well, Jay, just for the first thing, Dan Albert was here at Wisconsin, actually, and he was the chair here before I started, and actually left here, I think, just before I started, and now is in Oregon. So, you know, it's interesting to hear his perspectives. He even wrote an article that he cited here about the differences between his experiences at Harvard and at Wisconsin, the ninth reference in the article. So it's kind of interesting, the things that he brought up. I think in terms of the rotation of the chair, you know, they bring up some nice points. I think this is one of those things where it probably just depends on the culture and the department and the location for certain things. Rotation of that leadership role in some ways makes a lot of sense, right? Like, I'm sure you guys have at your institutions, just like us, committees where there is leadership that changes every number of years. You know, we have some of our most critical clinical committees where, or clinical practice committees where, you know, there's a different person who is rotated into that leadership position. You see that even in things like education, where like residency program directors rotate through that position, you know, over a certain amount of time, and that's usually someone who's taken from within. And so it, in some ways, that does make a lot of sense, right, to have someone who, you know, knows the system, has been at the institution, has some loyalty to the institution. On the same token, I think, you know, sometimes there are things about the chairperson's job that are not always desirable for a lot of the clinical faculty or, you know, practicing physicians. It does require a lot of time. Places where you have a large research element, you know, you may have a lot of clinical faculty who don't participate on the basic science side. Like, for example, in my practice, I do mostly clinical practice and clinical research. So I don't think I would be well equipped to handle the demands of our research counterparts and, you know, kind of making sure that that part of the department was under control. And then I think, you know, my experiences in New York, you know, there are a lot of patients, there's a lot more philanthropy there. So maybe the role of a single person who's going to be there for a while might be greater because you can kind of cultivate certain relationships with your, you know, contributors and donors to the department. So maybe that makes more sense.
Yeah, and like you mentioned all the places rotation has been used, but I mean, it's been used in politics too. I mean, our system is not set up that way with the presidency, but there's like a term limit still. You know, you serve for two terms, then you're done. And there are governments around the world where it's kind of a senior cabinet, and then the prime minister is selected from that and kind of rotates amongst the senior cabinet members, and they serve once or for X amount of time and then move on. I mean, I think the nice thing, like you said, is especially if they have other academic or clinical interests, is it's a fixed commitment, right? It's like you were going to be chair for X amount of time. There's a natural transition. There's a natural point at which you can stop and you can go back to what you enjoy doing. It also, I think, takes some pressure off in the sense that you don't have to feel like if you are removed as chair, I mean, they might be doing it just to change things up, but it's not like you're losing your position. It's not like a demotion. It's just part of the way it's set up. So I think psychologically it might be nice, though. Again, none of us are really, Ajay's the closest maybe, at the stage of being close to this.
Definitely
level.
Not.
you know, so anyway, I just wanted to talk about this because this is interesting because it's not only about what a chair means, but it's about what a department means and how success is measured. And that, like John said, is going to vary culture to culture. It's going to vary place to place. But I mean, it's good to see that residents and fellows is still something that's on a list like this. And, you know, they kind of end by saying that the most important thing is, you know, how are the faculty perceived by people who come in interviewing for a job or interviewing for residency, or, you know, are the faculty happy? And this is very much like when we talk about residency programs with the residency applicants, are the residents happy and the faculty happy? And all these things kind of factor into faculty happiness.
Yeah, and other places I've been, at least, I remember in training, you know, I was talking with someone about this, and they were saying sometimes it's nice to bring in someone from outside because that actually can kind of bring in a point of leverage. So, for example, they talk about assessing the department's strengths and weaknesses and opportunities, and someone from outside might be able to say, hey, you know, I see a great opportunity for this department to expand, you know, such and such part of your practice, and I would like to get a commitment from the medical school for that kind of a program. Whereas maybe someone from within may have a lot harder time, or, you know, it's a lot easier for the school to say no to them. Whereas maybe, you know, you're trying to recruit someone, you're going to try to kind of impress them to a degree and, you know, say, okay, we'll include that as part of your kind of package, so to speak. You know, Jay, I think, you know, it'd be great if you could get a chair on your podcast and talk to them about something like this. You know, that might
be spoiler, kind of spoiler interesting alert, to their perspective. Hidden preview.
Yeah.
In the near future.
But Jay, as always, you're a step ahead of me.
But all right, guys, well, thank you so much for your time and for talking about these articles with me. And our listeners always appreciate it, taking the time not only to come on the program, but to read these and take your notes and be up to date with the literature. So final notes before we go. NBA All-Star game was yesterday. No Knicks were in the game because Porzingis tore his knee. I'll just leave it up to the two of you. What are you looking forward to in the NBA season and with the Knicks at this point? Ajay?
Trying to tank as well as possible.
Tank so hard you lose every game?
That's my goal at this point. Yeah.
So someone asked me the other day, they said, are you a Knicks fan? I said, yes. And then they said, I'm so sorry. And I said, for what, the last 20 years? that's basically how it feels. And it doesn't look like it's getting any better. So, you know, maybe 2020?
I just have to say that there was a great point about, I don't remember who said this, I was listening to someone, basketball person, and they said the classic Knicks season of the last like 10 years or even 15 years is they start out okay, they're not awesome, but they start well enough that people get their hopes up, they look very promising, and then after like 25 to 30 games they start flaming out, and then around 50 the wheels just fall off the tires and they fall apart. But the problem is they played too well in the first 25 games, so they end up with like the 8th pick in the draft. And that's like the classic like Knicks story. The only time that didn't happen, they got Porzingis and they got the 4th pick. So I don't know. It's pretty hard to tank. There's a lot of really bad teams and they're all trying to tank.
They don't need the top pick. They just need the right pick. You know what I mean? There's plenty of good players in the middle first round. They just haven't found them. For a while, they didn't even have the picks. So, I mean, I think that's one thing for the Knicks looking ahead. You know, Porzingis will probably miss the first half of next year, which makes next year probably sunk. But that gives them two more potential lottery-level picks. And so then when he comes back, you could have two or three star players, and that actually might be a competitive team.
That sounds really optimistic to me. Oh, God.
And then LeBron will retire, you know.
Maybe.
Maybe.
He'll be playing on Golden State by then.
That's a separate topic for a separate day. John Chang, Ajay Curry, and thank you guys so much. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks for having me.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINA podcast.com. All 92 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal Round Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils, on the website. You can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes, and at the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback on things we can do better as well as things we're already doing well, and we appreciate all the positive reviews we've gotten in the iTunes Store through Apple Podcasts. Many thanks to Dr. Jonathan Chang and Dr. Ajay Kurian for their time. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Vinicasa, and Angela Chang for the great production. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.